Gorbachev. According to the Islamic teachings, man and woman are equal, but their role is definitely different in family and society based on their physical and psychological differences. Ayatollah Khamenei says, "The power of faith opened in the way of greater struggles for women and created astonishing and unique scenes of their brave, sacrificial and innovative presence in tough fields. From fervent demonstrations of the days of revolution to the unforgettable era of the holy defense, from championship in the rows of battle to abandoning children and husband and sending them towards danger to services behind the fronts, from presence in the front of sciences, research and technology, and radiation in the domain of literature and art, to artistic participation in social, political, and managerial arenas, and finally, self-sacrifice in the field of health and rendering services to patients in the recent perilous tribulation. All of these are the signs of spiritual sublimity of the Iranian woman, which has emerged with the blessings of the Islamic system and the lessons and values determined by Islam." A new book titled 40-Year Ascension has reviewed the successes of the Islamic Revolution during four decades, according to the global statistics. Before the revolution, only 6% of the university graduates were women, while the figure has reached almost 50%. In the current Iranian calendar year, more than 60% of participants of university entrance exam were female. Before the victory of the Islamic Revolution, almost no one of the university professors was female, while this has grown to 21%. Dr. Fahime Farahmandpour, a member of the scientific board of Tehran University, says, "I am one of the thousands of university teachers who have been trained in the Islamic Republic." Professor Zahra Imam Jom'e is a scholar whose name has been registered in the list of the Asian scientific centers. She teaches as the youngest Iranian professor. "The Islamic Revolution was successful in training 100,000 female physicians, many of whom are specialists and subspecialist in a variety of medical branches." Today, there are hundreds of social establishments in Iran that are presided and run by women. They include social assistance, support for parentless families, financial assistance, charity funds, and so on. Women are active in elections too. Even some of the officials of the electoral headquarters are female. Women have a prominent presence at media, so that approximately 70% of media activists are young women. As in the sports domain, Iranian Muslims have shown a bright participation both inside the country and abroad in various fields. Before the revolution, Iranian women had garnered only 5 medallions, and that in the Asian competitions, while they were forced to remove their hijab during the matches. This while today Iranian ladies are active in 130 sports fields and have gained nearly 200 medallions in various fields of sports. Moreover, Iranian women have been successful in sports-affiliated fields too. For instance, پریا شهریاری has entered the FIFA base as the first Iranian lady. She has been the manager of Iran's beach football committee for 19 years. Tony Grant, a critic of feminism, writes, "Today it seems that women have become only independent, but emotionally they are often more needful, insecure, shaky, lonely, and destitute than their mothers and grandmothers."
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
The balloon's journey across the ocean has gripped the world's attention. On Friday, the U.S. military said it mobilized fighter jets, but advised President Joe Biden against shooting the balloon out of the sky for fear debris could pose a safety threat. U.S. authorities said the military took custody of the balloon when it entered America's airspace. On Saturday, however, U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin said the balloon, which was being used by China in an attempt to surveil strategic sites in the continental United States, was brought down above U.S. territorial waters. Pentagon also snapped what it called China's unacceptable violation. China has expressed regret, blaming winds for pushing what it called civilian airship into U.S. airspace. Beijing said the balloon was used for meteorological purposes and had unintentionally escaped into U.S. airspace. The incident prompted U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken to issue a personal note to his Chinese counterpart condemning Beijing's move.
China's decision to fly a surveillance balloon over the continental United States is both unacceptable and irresponsible. That's what this is about. It's a violation of our sovereignty. It's a violation of international law.
Blinken further added that the U.S. remains committed to diplomatic engagement with China and that he would make a trip to Beijing once conditions are favorable. Some White House allies say postponing Blinken's trip was an overreaction to the incident, particularly because U.S. officials have said that they do not think the balloon was able to gather information that cannot be acquired in other ways, such as spy satellites. In a phone call with his American counterpart, Chinese Foreign Minister Wang Yi said China and the United States should handle occasional individual cases in a calm and professional manner. Wang stressed that China has always strictly abided by international laws and will not accept any groundless conjecture or hype. In the face of unexpected situations, what both sides should do is to maintain steadiness, communicate in time, avoid misjudgment, and manage differences. Meanwhile, the Pentagon said it spotted a second similar balloon flying over Latin America. Beijing already denied the U.S. accusation of spying. It accused U.S. media and politicians of using the recent balloon incident as a pretext to launch a smear campaign against Beijing. The U.S. allegation of a suspected spy balloon flying in the sky of Montana has added to concerns that the already heightened tensions between Washington and Beijing would further escalate. Although balloons are a powerful potential surveillance tool, it is odd that Beijing would do something this provocative just before a key U.S. diplomatic trip, especially since China has been pushing to repair relations with the United States post-pandemic. Some in the U.S. say it is very likely that China has been using this technique for a while and that the United States was aware of it, but diplomatically chose not to respond. A U.S. Defense Department spokesman confirmed that such intrusions have happened before, saying it is not the first time that you had a balloon of this nature cross over the continental United States. It has happened a handful of other times over the past few years, to include before this administration. Some believe that the United States is spending a large budget on creating unnecessary hostility with China. Some others reason out that the tensions have flared up in recent years between the two, with Biden declaring that China is America's most consequential geopolitical challenge and competition between the two global superpowers is intense. After all, Washington and Beijing are already at loggerheads over a host of issues. That includes tensions over Taiwan. President Biden has antagonized top Chinese officials by saying on several occasions that the United States would defend Taiwan if China attacked a self-ruled island. One close ally of the administration said that although White House officials have walked back those statements, Biden is intentionally sending a message to China when he makes such pronouncements. But tensions between Washington and Beijing are not limited to that. The two powers have deep differences on other issues as well. The economic war between the United States and China, with the two countries having imposed tariffs on each other's goods, can be named as such. The U.S. presence in the South China Sea also adds to concerns that Washington and Beijing would be facing each other militarily. In the current situation, one small excuse would be enough for the whole world to wage another world war.
The United States is ramping up its efforts to counter China's growing regional power. Amid Washington's rising tensions with Beijing over the South China Sea and Taiwan, Washington and Manila agreed on plans to accelerate the full implementation of the, quote, Enhanced Defense Cooperation Agreement, with the full agreement to designate four new agreed locations in strategic areas of the Philippines. The deal would allow Washington to deploy military equipment and rotate its troops to four more bases. Washington has currently five bases in the Philippines. The two sides also agreed on the substantial completion of the project in existing agreed locations.
Today, Secretary Galvez and I also reaffirmed our mutual defense treaty commitments. And we'd note that the mutual defense treaty applies to armed attacks on either of our armed forces, public vessels, or aircraft anywhere in the South China Sea or the West Philippine Sea.
According to experts, Washington's access to those bases could provide U.S. forces a strategic position from which to mount operations in the event of a conflict over Chinese Taipei or in the South China Sea. China has criticized the U.S. for its plan to increase its military presence in the Philippines, warning that granting the U.S. greater access to military bases by Manila could hurt regional stability and raise tensions. The move is part of U.S. plans to encircle China's maritime border in anticipation of a war over Taiwan, which Beijing considers as its own. Last year, tensions rose to unprecedented levels after the then U.S. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi visited the island. China has repeatedly warned against any attempt that delegitimizes its national sovereignty. Furthermore, China claims sovereignty over virtually all of the South China Sea, which is also claimed in part by Brunei, Vietnam, Malaysia, and the Philippines. The waters are believed to sit atop vast reserves of oil and gas. In another attempt to counter China, the U.S. has opened an embassy in the Solomon Islands after a 30-year absence as it seeks to boost diplomatic relations in the Pacific. The last U.S. embassy in the Solomon Islands closed in 1993. The move comes after China struck a security pact with Solomon Islands last year. It was the first known bilateral security agreement between China and a country in the Pacific. The region has become the center of a geopolitical and strategic tug-of-war between China and the U.S. Meanwhile, NATO, which is a U.S.-led military bloc, is trying to bolster its ties with Japan in a bid to strengthen an alliance against China. The NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg has visited Japan, saying the Western military alliance will continue to strengthen its partnership with Tokyo.
Beijing is watching closely and learning lessons that may influence its future decisions. What is happening in Europe today could happen in East Asia tomorrow. So we must remain united and firm standing together for freedom and democracy.
Japan is a close ally of the U.S., and in recent years, it has expanded its military ties with other Indo-Pacific nations, as well as the United Kingdom, Europe, and NATO. Back in December, Tokyo unveiled a new national security strategy that will see a large increase in its military capabilities. The strategy includes the deployment of long-range missiles. Japan also hopes to ease restrictions on arms export to strengthen its military industry.
The harsh treatment of the Israeli regime against Palestinian prisoners is continuing unabated. At least 120 Palestinian inmates in an Israeli jail are on hunger strike in protest against the regime's repressive measures. The Palestinian Prisoners' Society has said the Palestinian political prisoners started the mass strike to protest against the inhumane conditions at Israel's notorious Negev prison.
Ben-Gavir announced plans to implement several punitive measures against incarcerated Palestinians, and he's continuing with more aggressive decisions. These measures are meant to drag the Palestinian prisoners into confrontations with the soldiers.
The commission said the inmates announced their decision to launch a hunger strike in response to the new repressive measures imposed on them by Israeli prison authorities. The development came after Israeli forces stormed several sections in Megiddo, Ofer, and Negev Desert prisons, attacking Palestinian prisoners and placing a group of them in solitary confinement. The Palestinian resistance factions have warned that the tension in prisons will not stay within their walls. They say harming the prisoners will have repercussions within and outside Israeli prisons.
The vicious attack on the prisoners will lead to serious consequences. The prisoners are not alone. They always find support and serious stand from the whole Palestinians. It seems this current regime wants a war on all fronts because the situation in the occupied territories is already boiling.
Reports say the move is in response to the abuses suffered by inmates in Section 26 and 27 in the Negev, the transfer of others from Section 8 to Section 6 in the same prison, and depriving them of their possessions and basic needs. Hundreds of Palestinian prisoners are held under administrative detention, in which Israel keeps the detainees without charge for up to 6 months, a period which can be extended an infinite number of times. The detention takes place on orders from a military commander and on the basis of what the Israeli regime describes as secret evidence. Some prisoners have been held in administrative detention for up to 11 years. Rights groups describe Israel's use of administrative detention as a bankrupt tactic and have long called on Israel to end this move.
The decisions of the Israeli cabinet are only about using much more violence, fierce violence against Palestinian people, and about consolidating the system of racial discrimination and occupation. Their decisions will not change much and will not break the Palestinian resistance. And in my opinion, this government is failing and will continue to fail because fascism cannot prevail. And nobody can break the will of the Palestinian people to struggle to be free.
There are reportedly more than 7,000 Palestinians held in Israeli jails. Human rights organizations say Israel violates all the rights and freedoms granted to prisoners by the Fourth Geneva Convention. Palestinian detainees have continuously resorted to open-ended hunger strikes in an attempt to express outrage at the illegal detentions. Israeli jail authorities keep Palestinian prisoners under deplorable conditions without proper hygienic standards. Palestinian inmates have also been subject to systematic torture, harassment, and repression.
The U.S. announced on January 25th that it will send 31 M1 Abrams tanks to Ukraine. The tanks may take months or even years to arrive and may never see the battlefield. The M1 Abrams is the main battle tank of the U.S. military and is one of the most powerful and sophisticated tanks in the world. But for Ukraine, that is both the advantage and the problem. In his comments announcing the decision, U.S. President Joe Biden said that delivering the tanks to Ukraine will take time without further specification.
Today, I'm announcing that the United States will be sending 31 Abrams tanks to Ukraine, the equivalent of one Ukrainian battalion. Secretary Austin has recommended this step because it will enhance the Ukraine's capacity to defend its territory and achieve its strategic objectives. The Abrams tanks are the most capable tanks in the world. They're also extremely complex to operate and maintain. So we're also giving Ukraine the parts and equipment necessary to effectively sustain these tanks on the battlefield.
Military analysts say it could take a year or more for all these Abrams to make it to Ukraine. So any expectations that these tanks will have an immediate impact on the fighting needs to be tempered. The tanks will be purchased from General Dynamics, the manufacturer of the tank. National Security Council spokesman John Kirby said it will take many months for General Dynamics to build them. Kirby said the U.S. doesn't have the extra tanks in its arsenal, and even if there were excess tanks, it would still take many months, suggesting that the unbuilt tanks will take even longer to arrive. While the estimated timeline suggests that the tanks cannot have an immediate impact on the conflict, it seems that may never have been the intention. The decision may have been more strategic and diplomatic than military. The Biden administration made the decision against the advice of the Pentagon. The tank the U.S. really wants on the battlefields of Ukraine is the German Leopard 2. But Germany was never going to send them without the cover of the U.S. agreeing to send their tanks. In case there was any doubt, on January 19th, at the World Economic Forum, German Chancellor Olaf Scholz privately but very directly told the U.S. delegation that Germany was not going to send their tanks until the U.S. agreed to send theirs. The U.S. may never have intended the Abrams tanks for the current war. They may not even be the right tanks for this war. U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin and Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff Mark Milley had both recommended against sending M1 Abrams tanks to Ukraine. In addition to how long it takes to train personnel to operate the tanks and how difficult the tanks are to maintain, they have also said that the Abrams tanks are not the right vehicles for the fight in Ukraine right now. By promising to send the tanks without ever specifying a delivery date, the U.S. may have succeeded in giving Germany and Europe cover to send their Leopard tanks without ever actually sending U.S. tanks onto the current battlefield. Most NATO members in Europe have kept open the possibility of sending their F-16 fighter jets to Ukraine, even as U.S. President Joe Biden said Washington would not do so. Air defense experts say U.S.-built F-16 fighter jets would offer Ukraine an edge over the Russian Air Force, but only if combined with powerful missiles and targeting information which the West would also have to provide, drawing it more actively into the war. There are clear advantages to the F-16. It is the world's most produced fighter jet, with many being decommissioned in Europe as NATO members transition to the F-35. Lockheed Martin, which produces the F-16, told the Financial Times it can increase production to replace planes sent to Ukraine. But there are practical and symbolic concerns. Experts say training Ukrainian pilots on F-16s might not be carried out in time to make a difference in the war this year. Also, bringing in Western pilots, even as privateers, could create political complications. Ukraine has reportedly prepared a batch of 50 pilots who have flown in Western military exercises and could be trained in 3 months. The symbolic concern is over losses of aircraft. Russia's development of hypersonic missiles could prove a match for the F-16, ending the narrative of NATO superiority. Perhaps for such reasons, there are still naysayers in the Western alliance. German Chancellor Olaf Scholz, after bowing to pressure to send Leopard 2 battle tanks to Ukraine, said he would not be sending the jets. The West, the U.S. in particular, has supplied Ukraine with arms and munitions worth billions of dollars since the beginning of the war in February last year. Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky has recently doubled down on the need for new weapons from his Western backers to counter Russia's military advances, urging the West to send long-range missiles and fighter jets in addition to tanks.
We have to open the supply of long-range missiles to Ukraine, and it is important that we expand our cooperation in artillery, and we have to start supplying aircraft to Ukraine. This is our dream and our task.
Russia has frequently warned that Western weapons supply to Ukraine will only prolong the war.
When the whole world is silent towards oppression, even one voice becomes powerful. IRIB English Radio, the voice of the voiceless. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is the part of the speech delivered by the leader of the Islamic Revolution during a meeting with a number of eulogists and religious poets in the Imam Khomeini Husseiniya on January 12, 2023. The meeting took place one day before the anniversary of the birth of Lady Fatima Zahra Salamullah Aliha. It has been stated numerous places in the Quran, then bring a chapter like it. Chapter 2, verse 23. They were not able to produce even one verse similar to the verse of the Holy Quran. Nahjul Balagha, the peak of eloquence, possesses the utmost magnificence, logic, and beauty. The same applies to Sahifat al-Sajjadiyya. The Abu Hamza Thumali supplication, Imam Hussein's supplication on the day of Arafah, and various other supplications, they are all incredibly beautiful. Your art is a continuation of that art. This art can be said to be comprehensive when all its parts are beautiful. It's not enough for just its appearance to be beautiful. The content must also be beautiful. The Quran has a wonderful appearance and inside it is deep in meaning. This is what Imam Ali alayhi salam says in Nahj al-Balagha Sermon 18.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
The inside of Quran is deep and full of meaning. Now, we do not expect ourselves. I don't expect you to presume that you can produce something similar to it. No. But this is what we should have in mind. That is, the appearance should be beautiful, and the core needs to be filled with meaning and be logical. The same goes for melody. I had particularly planned to talk about this with you, dear elegist and eulogist. A song has meaning. It conveys a meaning. so you may perform a sign that does not even have any words. For example, some people produce music from their throat, or some may use instruments to create music. It has no words, but it has meaning. It conveys a meaning. That is how music is. Some songs inspire courage. For example, the song that Haj Sadiq Ohangaran, the famous elegist of the Sacred Defense era, was singing. O army of Sahib Zaman, be prepared, be prepared. Even if the song hadn't had any lyrics, the tone of the song is one that inspires being prepared. Some songs bring depression. They make people depressed. They discourage people. They are different. Some songs lead people towards sins. Many of the songs that are set to instrumental music are like this.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope.
Economic Divide.
The Islamic Revolution turns 44, and the Islamic Republic is standing tall, despite the maximum pressure or extreme pressure campaign by the West. How did it get there, and what strides has it made economically? Well, in this edition of the program, we will look at some of the major achievements of the Islamic Republic, which will also include some sound bites of people's grievances during the Shah's regime, which you may have not heard. All right, some of the highlights coming up in this program. The oil economy under the Pahlavi regime, the resources of oil was plundered. Then comes the democratically elected Prime Minister Mossad Deq, the oil aspirations that he had. We will take a look at that very closely. And also the different ways that Iran's economy has moved away from oil. Another highlight, Iran's achievements. It has become a regional power. No questions about that. Also, the expansion of the middle class is one of the fruits of the Islamic Revolution, along with the nationalization of key industries. And then something that was required, that needed to be done, and it was called the resistance economy. Promoting economic self-reliance, also defeating U.S. trade sanctions, one of the purposes behind that, and another reason to discourage extravagant consumption. Iran is a vast country in the West Asia region, which sits on huge oil and gas resources. Iran's oil industry began in 1901 after Qajar kings gave a concession to British speculator William Darcy to explore and to develop southern Iran's oil resources. Masjid al-Suleiman, located in Khuzestan province in the southwest of the Islamic Republic of Iran, was the country's first oil well. It was drilled in 1908. It is also the first oil well in West Asia. The discovery led to the formation in 1909 of the London-based Anglo-Persian Oil Company. In fact, the British government gained direct control of the Iranian oil industry. UK's hegemony over Iran's oil industry and its revenue triggered a backlash among nationalist Iranian politicians, including Mohammad Mossadegh, who later became Iran's prime minister. Mossadegh and his ally, Ayatollah Khashoggi, led a movement to nationalize Iran's oil, but the split between the two and Mossadegh's misplaced trust in the U.S. led to his downfall. In 1953, the UK and the U.S. staged a coup against Mossadegh and toppled his government. Iran's oil industry and its revenues were once again under the control of Western countries, especially the U.S. and the United Kingdom. The Shah's regime used the oil revenue to buy Western weapons and industrial products, which mainly benefited Western producers. During this period, Iran's oil industry remained disconnected from other industries, particularly manufacturing. This separation promoted inefficiencies in the country's overall industrial economy. It's time now to take a look at some of the social media posts. First off, Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, visited the exhibition of industrial capabilities at Imam Khomeini's Husseinia. It went on to say, based on the entry, the exhibition featured machinery, equipment, and products manufactured by various plants and factories in Iran. Iran's ministries of industries, energy, oil, and communications were all represented at the exhibition. Obviously, this shows the advancement of Iran. Next up, get to know the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps. Here are some of the missions of Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps, or the IRGC, in brief. The various ways that the IRGC not only secures Iran's security, but also its activities in different fields when it comes to Iran's economy and the Islamic Republic as a whole. Next, the Islamic Revolution has taken the responsibility of saying no to the culture of the Western world, so that the real future of nations can be determined through ignoring the Western culture. The hashtag here, important, powerful Iran. Then Iran's economy after the Islamic Revolution, the GDP, 1978 through 2021, 75%. And of course, we're looking at the economic growth in 43 years after the Islamic Revolution. Noteworthy, obviously, for this person to make this entry. All right, there you have it. Wish we had more time to actually peruse through some of these with you. But let's bring in our guest for this segment of the Q&A. We have Ali Rezmanpour, who's an international affairs expert, joining us. Ali Rezmanpour, welcome to Economic Divide. All right, from the time of the discovery of oil in Iran, you have foreign powers who obviously have lots of interest or had lots of interest in it, especially when it comes to what came to exploiting Iran as a whole, and to basically force it into concessions in order for them to contract the oil, or extract the oil, that is, and then for them to reap the benefits. Now, the nationalization of the oil industry was supposed to be a response to these foreign interventions led by Mohammad Mossadegh, the then prime minister of Iran, but he was forced out through a US-UK coup, which we all know. What benefits would a nationalization have brought Iranians at that time if it had been nationalized?
In the name of God, the compassionate, the merciful. From the time of exploitation of colonial powers which were present in Iran during the past 100 years, and especially from the time oil was discovered in Iran, the British government, the colonial powers, on top of them the United States and Great Britain, try to exploit Iranian oil. In these ways, we saw that different kinds of nationalistic movements in Iran, which tried to just nationalize Iranian oil industry, but it was thwarted by the policies, and especially by colonial policies of the British government, and they didn't allow Iran to just took control of its oil industry and send them into the international market.
Okay, Ahmed Saleh is our next guest. He joins us now. He's a political and economic analyst. Ahmed Saleh, welcome to Economic Divide. Why do you think when it comes to the deposed Shah of Iran, he was blasted so much for devoting his, his tenure to modernizing Iran? He was really blasted for that. Of course, the money to come from massive oil revenues. Basically, he was bulldozing his way into this mass industrialization program. But he was trying to push that through really quickly, which was said to be one of his downfalls. Of course, at the same time, it was plagued, from what we understand, by mismanagement and fraud, so much so that economists at the time actually privately acknowledged that, most of the money was actually wasted. Is that what happened?
Let me give you an important example to elaborate more in details of this mismanagement and misuse of the oil revenues. In 1971, when the Nixon shock took place and the price of the oil increased dramatically four times approximately in the world, and also due to the oil embargo of the Arab countries, the quantity of the export of oil in Iran also increased drastically. The statistics, there are different statistics, but the minimum increase in the oil revenue of Iran per capita was 10 times. So the income of Iran increased by 10 times. But how this money was used? A big portion, or most of this money, was used to just import the final products, consuming products from America and from European countries. So this money was recycled and went back again to the source. And we know that increased the loaning capacity of the banks in the United States, and this is called the cycle of the petrodollar, which saved the American dollar from drowning when it lost, after the Nixon shock, it lost 40% of its value against, for example, the German marks in less than a year.
It's time now for the InfoNews section of the program. First up, we're going to take a look at a subject called common currency. Who does it pertain to? Which countries? Well, Argentina and Brazil. They actually have begun talks on forming a common currency. Now, the currency would be limited to trade and would not replace the two countries' currencies. At this point, there are also reports that these talks are on hold. But according to the latest that we have, is that they are still in the process of trying to somewhat come up with a structure for that. But it's definitely in the works. Next up, a look at Russia, Iran, and the trade between the two countries. Turnover is expected to grow under a new trade or free trade agreement between Tehran and the Eurasian Economic Union. Now, trade has surged by 15% last year, reaching $4.6 billion. Also on a side note, the news has come out that the SWIFT-like banking system has now been established between Russia and Iran. Not established, it's actually now operational, and it has started its operation in the past 48 hours as of the recording of this program. So that's somewhat related news there. Now, Nigeria is the next topic we're taking a look at in terms of the cashless environment there. It has launched a domestic card scheme to boost the cashless economy in that country. Now, this move is part of the central bank's efforts to reduce cash flow within the borders of the country, which is Africa's biggest economy. Next up, we're going to take a look at a topic that we haven't covered in a while. This pertains to Arab countries and the currencies in those countries as a whole. Now, it appears that there's government mismanagement and external pressures that has been a result of the currency crash in some Arab countries. Now, why is that happening? Well, these Arab countries outside of the Persian Gulf have actually seen their currency devalue, and as a result, inflation has risen. Now, one particular country that is suffering from this is Iraq. Iraq, however, is blaming the U.S. for its currency devaluation, and that leads some to believe that the U.S. is using the dollar as a weapon, something that the U.S. has been accused of time and time again in the past.
Economic Divide. The series looks at the financial health of the economies around the world and its impact on countries. You can listen to Economic Divide on Mondays and Tuesdays on IRIB English Radio.
Before and after the revolution. This is the title for our in-depth section. After all, what better way to gauge how the Islamic revolution is doing by taking a look at these angles? But don't forget, this is looking through the economic lens. Obviously, there are other factors at play when it comes to the performance of the Islamic revolution as a whole. Okay, first up, let's take a look at these industries, in particular, cement, aluminum, copper, and electricity. When you take a look at them, we want to see how they fared before, obviously, and after the Islamic revolution. Now, let me draw your attention to the ranking in the world and the percentage increase when it comes to them, as you see over here. That's what we want to take a look at. These are unbelievable figures. The ranking, 25, 7, not the ranking, but the amount of volume of that it has increased by 25, 17, 35-fold that you see there. It's at the bottom of your screen there, 25-fold for cement, 17-fold increase for aluminum, and then you have, 35-fold increase for copper, electricity, obviously also to have increased in its production. Not only does Iran provide its people with the lowest price electricity in the world, its ranking is 16th in the world. So you can see how much Iran has improved ever since the Islamic Revolution. And if that doesn't convince you of how Iran has jumped leaps and bounds after the Islamic Revolution, well, here is another industry that may just blow your mind, the steel industry. Take a look at that in terms of the production and also in terms of the ranking. This just came out recently. Now, aside from the 19-fold increase and it being 10th in the world, again, hold on to your horses. As of November of 2022, Iran's steel industry's ranking actually increased to the 7th place in the world with a production of 2.9 million tons. Now, to put things into perspective, this is while EU faced a 10.1% decrease in its steel production due to the energy crisis. Okay. Now, as far as the Iranian economy goes, we took a look at the IMF. It issued a report predicting the gross domestic product, or GDP, of 192 countries of the world, including, obviously, the Islamic Republic of Iran. The body expects Iran's GDP to reach $1,599 billion in the current year, based on the Purchasing Power Index, or PPI, the rate of which will increase by $150 billion as compared to last year. Now, according to the IMF statistics, Iran is the 21st largest economic power in the world in 2022, in spite of the tough economic sanctions that have been imposed or placed against the country. And finally, the Western maximum pressure campaign, especially by the U.S., well, has been one of the most severe in history, well, maybe now second to Russia, but here are a few examples of the damage that it has done to Iran's economy. As you can see over here with oil production, 1.5 million barrels coming off the market, to revenue denied, to corporations that have exited the country, obviously in these sectors, and these are just a few that show the way that the Western powers, particularly the U.S., have tried to put extreme pressure on Iran, which has failed in terms of the maximum pressure campaign. Let me bring back our guests and get an idea from them. Ali Rezvanpour is an international affairs expert who rejoins us. Ali Rezvanpour, welcome back to Economic Divide. Now, taking a look at Iran in terms of it being a regional power, I mean, we're looking at four decades, basically, of the way that Iran has been able to do that. Different spheres, social, economic, diplomatic, and military investments. And also, we are looking at Iran's civilian nuclear energy program to have expanded. Just in the steel sector, we have now come in at 7th in the world. How did Iran reach these achievements now and not during the time of the Shah, and the deposed Shah and its regime?
We have witnessed the advancement of Iranian, infrastructures, different kinds of infrastructures during the past couple of decades, especially about economic and also industrial issues. Iran has relied on its own ability, on its own knowledge-based companies, on its own knowledge-based institutes in order to improve its infrastructure. You have already seen that regarding nuclear, energy, Iranian scientists have been completely successful in enriching uranium for civilian purpose or for civilian usage, and also they have used different kinds of, knowledge, different kinds of, advancement regarding nuclear technology in order to use in different kinds of, infrastructures. So why Iran achieve these advancements and achieve these, improvements? Because it's even though, the international community, especially the United Nations and also the U.S. government, impose different kinds of harsh sanctions against Iran, Iran, by relying on its own ability, try to just prevent the harmful effects of sanctions on its own economy and improve its infrastructure and use them for the benefit of its own people.
Okay, let's bring back Ahmad Salehi, political and economic analyst, see what he thinks. Ahmad Salehi, I want to come at you with the issue of human resources, because when it comes to the advancement of any economy in Iran, obviously, is not an exception. One of the things that does stand out is human resources, but that has to happen through educational advancements in a country, which Iran has by leaps and bounds been able to excel in. Now, the big question is, how did it manage to do that in this sector? Because some are under the false impression that the Islamic establishment, when there's a government under that, that educational learning is not something that's going to equal a Western one. So tell us more about that, if you can.
One of the main purpose of all the structures in a society, economic structures, social structures, political, military, anything, security, is the improvement in human resources. And United Nations has a very important index to compare the situation of countries in this regard. And this is the HDI, Human Development Index, which is very important, and it's mainly consisted of, very different parameters, but mainly categorized into three different factors: the income of the population, the health, and the education. And if you compare those 120 countries, which are the high HDI countries, Iran's rank is among the top three countries. So this is like a miracle. The development of the human resources. And by these human resources, we are talking about men, women, and different types of people.
All right, he mentioned the word miracle. It's a good time to take a look at the area of human resources through Iran's 7th development plan. Here is where it would be a good time to look at the role of women and how far they have come thanks to the opportunities created for them. Well, the numbers speak for themselves, as you're about to see. This table outlines how far women have come in the Islamic Republic. Now, note the female literacy rate in rural areas, which expanded from 17% all the way to 73%. No matter how you look at it, women have come a long way since the Islamic Revolution. Following the 1978 revolution, the National Iranian Oil Company took control of Iran's petroleum industry. Iran also tried to rid itself from Western companies to develop an independent gas and oil industry. Iranian officials also defined as intergenerational capital. Western powers have imposed sanctions on Iran in order to prevent the country's ability to extract and to sell oil in international markets. The sanctions have created problems for Iran, but Iranian officials have devised various plans to stave off the sanctions and to develop mega projects in the country's oil and gas sectors. The Islamic Republic is now a regional power thanks to four decades of social, economic, diplomatic, and military advancements. The government used oil revenues to build highways, railways, factories, power plants, airports, and other infrastructure. Iran has also invested in peaceful nuclear technology in order to meet its rising energy needs. Iran is now a major producer in the steel sector. It is among the top 10 steel producing countries in recent years.
When it comes to the Islamic Republic and its vision for the future, these are plans that have already been drawn up. That is what we'll be covering in this segment, along with some of its accomplishments. First, the 20-year national vision, which was presented in the year 2005. Iranian society at the dawn of the national vision, the year 2024, will have these features: development in proportion to its cultural, geographical, and historic requirements, founded on Islamic and revolutionary values, in possession of like in science and technology and reliant on a greater share of human resources and advancement in a secure, independent and powerful defense system based on multilateral deterrence. Perhaps at the core of the Islamic Republic's economy lies a doctrine which is called a resistance economy. Iran's resistance economy policies, outlined by Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, were meant to insulate Iran from the severe effects of Western sanctions. From 2013 onward, Iran embarked on this program geared towards significantly reducing its budgetary reliance on oil. That is because the budget bills focused on things like infrastructure reforms, health, and job creation. The seventh development plan was presented by Iran's leader in 2022 with a focus on economic progress. Comprising 26 provisions, the plan includes seven main chapters about economic issues, infrastructural affairs, cultural and scientific issues, to name a few. According to the general policies, the seventh development plan's main goal and priority is economic progress coupled with justice, with an average rate of 8% during the five-year period, with an emphasis on increasing productivity, including human resources. That does it for this segment of the program. Thanks for joining us. Please send us your thoughts. We would love to hear from you.
The Islamic Republic of Iran has withstood the test of time. Now it is entering a new phase, a shift to the east. With countries like Russia and China, which Iran has strategic agreements with, and with its membership in trade blocs like the SCO and soon-to-be BRICS, the era of Western-dominated influence will come to an end, and Iran can prosper in the way that it truly deserves, because the maximum pressure campaign has failed. That does it for this edition of the program. Hope you enjoyed it. From Mikhail Tahvei, it's goodbye until the next Economic Divide.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio. With you every single moment.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pourreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
With reporters.
South Korean families of the victims of the crowd crush that killed 159 mostly young people last Halloween gathered at the memorial in Itaewon on Saturday to mark 100 days since the tragedy. They demand a thorough independent probe and accountability.
We definitely need to know the reason why our children died here last October 29th. I think the only thing we can do for our sons and daughters who left this world for no reason is to hold those responsible and punish them.
Demonstrators marched from the memorial past the presidential office. 11 emergency calls were made in the hours before the disaster. Local officials knew tens of thousands would gather in Itaewon, but crowd control was not implemented. Still, the safety minister said the deaths could not have been prevented, angering family members. One investigation has led to a handful of indictments of police on duty and low-level officials, but top officials have been spared.
Naturally, it is the President, the Minister of the Interior and Safety, and the Commissioner of the National Police Agency who are obliged to take responsibility for the lives and safety of citizens. But from the beginning, right after the disaster, they sought to avoid responsibility, and politicians continued to insult the families and victims.
City Hall denied the marchers access to the nearby plaza for their demonstration, as the fallout from the tragedy turns ever more political. 26 foreigners died in the crowd crush last Halloween. Five of those were young Iranian exchange students. And as the families and their supporters seek justice, they face harassment and official indifference.